floor is now set for Stacy Steele.
Good afternoon, council.
May I please report? The court chancery granted a motion to dismiss plaintiff's complaint challenging a transaction where News Corp acquired General Motors retained interest in used electronics, and GM's Class H stock was exchanged for used common stock, and then News acquired by merger 17% of the used stock of the former GMH holders. Because the $14 per share offered for GM's retained interest did not give GM as much cash as it wanted for its pension plans, GM extracted a $275 million cash dividend for used, or about an extra $1 per share. The transaction, the complaint, and the issues on the appeal are complex and multifaceted and have been explained in the briefs. Without waiving any arguments, I will limit my comments to selected elements of the primary grounds we assert for reversal. I'm, of course, happy to address the court's questions on any of the issues raised in the briefs. On reply, Mr. Jarvis will briefly respond to News Corp's cross-appeal argument on jurisdiction. The two primary grounds for reversal are, first, the Court of Chancery's erroneous application of the standards governing a motion to dismiss, and second, the Chancellor's reliance on ratification by the GM stockholders, despite the complaint's allegations that the vote was manipulated, the disclosure was misleading, and the GM certificate required a two-thirds vote. As this Court indicated in Krasner v. Moffitt, ratification usually cannot be resolved on a motion to dismiss. The transaction here was entered into by GM as part of an effort to eliminate a $20 billion underfunding of its pension plans. So the principal beneficiaries of the transaction were GM's pension plans and the employees and retirees who were participants in those plans. GM paid over $3 billion in cash proceeds and the $275 million special dividend into the plans for the benefit of the employees and retirees. Moreover, as a result of the transaction, the GM plans were able to recognize a greater value for their GMH shares and were free from certain restrictions on transfer. Because the transaction was designed to benefit the GM plans and the participants therein, the plans and the employees and retirees who owned GMH stock had a financial interest in the transaction that was substantially different from and in certain respects opposed to the interest of the other GMH holders. The complaint alleges that most of the votes for the used transaction were from the GM plans and the employees. Now, just before announcing the used transaction, GM issued 149 million additional GMH shares to its pension plans, thereby converting non-voting notional shares representing GM's retained economic interest in used into outstanding GMH shares to be voted by the plan trustee. So following that contribution, the GM plans then owned 35% of the GMH shares. The complaint alleges that under ERISA, the plan trustee was obligated to vote these newly issued shares, as well as other GMH shares held by the plans, to further the interests of the plan's participants in getting the more than $3 billion in benefits from the proceeds and other benefits from the used transaction that GM would be putting into the plans. Despite these special financial and legal factors militating that the plan's shares would be voted for the transaction, the court below erroneously held that the plan's interests were, quote, totally aligned with the non-affiliated shares, end quote. Now, in dismissing the complaint, the Court of Chancery essentially established new pleading standards that are impossible to meet. The court did not accept as true the complaint's allegations that GM manipulated the vote by issuing the 149 million GMH shares to the pension plans, and by making special solicitations to GM and use employees. Instead, the court simply accepted as fact an SEC filing containing what GM said were the results of the vote, though there was no independent inspector of election. The Court of Chancery's reliance on the hearsay in GM's SEC filings is contrary to this court's decision in Santa Fe. The court also further erroneously held that GM's representations from outside the complaint should be accepted as true because the allegations of the complaint did not disprove GM's statement regarding the outcome of the stockholder vote.
Now, just to interrupt you for a moment, GM's answering brief on page 12, really quote the trial record saying there was no reason to dispute the disclosures regarding that the vote totals are correct. Is that an accurate characterization of what happened in the court chancery?
We don't think so, Your Honor, because as we pointed out, we think the vote was manipulated. We think that, that most of the votes that were counted were from stockholders who had a special financial interest in the transaction, the plans and the employees. However, we were denied discovery into the vote. We sought that. And for example, we can't tell how many shares were voted by employees and retirees. We don't know that. In fact, the court said, faulted us for not including allegations in our complaint about how the public shares were voted. Well, we can't know that without discovery. And so that's the difficulty is that and I think my co-counsel was being candid in terms of course, we haven't seen the consent, so we can't say that this consent was invalid or there was some problem with it, because GM was totally in control of the vote, and there's no independent inspector or other source that would allow the court, for example, to take judicial notice of that, because it's not from a source whose reliability cannot be questioned, and it's basically hearsay from GM. So that, and the fact that they put it into a 10-Q in this post-Enron era, that hardly means you can assume that everything in a 10-Q or an SEC filing is correct. Indeed, many companies, including recently GM itself, have restated financial results that are in 10-Qs or other SEC filings. So the fact that they said, oh, this is what we say the results were, that's from outside the complaint, and we were given no opportunity to test that, and we allege in the complaint reasons why we believe that the vote was not a valid vote, including the fact that they needed a two-thirds vote under the certificate.
So it's not so much the fact that a public document was cited in support of a motion to dismiss as it is that public document contained facts which might be controversial, but you have no access to information with which to controvert it.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we've done one of the things, I apologize for the length of the complaint, but one of the things we've done, because we saw this coming, was we tried to put in as much as what we could gather in the public record as possible in support of our claims. But there were areas where when the defendants first filed their motion to dismiss, they filed a brief that had lots of contentions that essentially assumed that facts in the consent solicitation were facts. We sought discovery as to those items. We sought discovery as to the vote, and at the defendant's opposition, we were denied all discovery into that. But now we're told, look, the vote is what it is. It was in a 10-Q, and therefore it's final.
So this kind of segues into the argument in the brief that relates to whether it's proper to take judicial notice on a motion to dismiss. And then the cases seem to indicate that you can take judicial notice of things that no one could reasonably dispute. And in this case, it's your position that these could reasonably be disputed if you had more information.
That's correct, Your Honor. And particularly in the context of ratification, where you're talking about did you get a majority of disinterested stockholders, or is the case, as we maintain, that essentially most of the votes that were obtained came from the plans and came from employees and retirees who had about 3 billion reasons to favor this transaction that did not apply to the other stockholders. And we're precluded from inquiring into that. I think the court also imposed improper pleading standards concerning the complaint allegations of director interest and lack of independence. Because GM needed the over $4 billion from the Hughes transaction to reduce the underfunding of its pension plans, the complaint alleges that the members of the GM board, who were also on GM's investment funds committee, had a separate and conflicting fiduciary duty under ERISA to GM's pension plans and their participants that conflicted with their director's fiduciary duty to the GMH shareholders under Delaware law. Now, despite these conflicting legal duties, the Court of Chancery held that plaintiffs must plead a material and overriding personal interest on the part of each of those directors in order to show that they were not disinterested and independent. We think the case law in this court has been clear that when you owe fiduciary duties to two different entities, to two different groups in separate entities, that's a conflict. And the court instead said, no, that's not good enough. You have to say that there was some personal benefit or personal interest for the individual director. We don't think that's a correct statement of the law.
Well, as you know, in your opponent's brief, they try to make the analogy to a choice between differing constituencies, and that frequently you have to decide between competing constituencies and exercising your fiduciary duties. But you're saying there were not different constituencies, there were competing fiduciary duties.
That's correct. From different sources, yeah, they're citing cases where it's two groups of stockholders and the directors owe the same fiduciary duty to all the stockholders. Here, it's two separate fiduciary duties, one under ERISA, one under Delaware law, and they're owed to two separate groups of people. It's more similar to where you have directors wearing two hats, where they both are directors of the controlling stockholder, say, and the subsidiary corporation. They owe fiduciary duties to the parent and its stockholders, and they owe fiduciary duties to the subsidiary and its stockholders.
Something like Weinberg.
Similar, Your Honor. We think the Court of Chancery also misapplied the standard for determining director interest and independence by holding that plaintiffs had to plead that the unusually large fees GM paid its outside directors were material to the director's personal circumstances. We don't think that's what the subjective materiality standard under CD means. It's not a sliding scale where one axis is your personal net worth and the other axis is how much money is being paid. We also think, again, how would a plaintiff know the personal economic circumstances of all the directors on the GM board? Again, it's an impossible pleading standard. Let me touch briefly on disclosure. The consent solicitation claimed that the $275 million special dividend was to compensate GM for the value enhancement the GMH holders would get from a one-for-one exchange of tracking stock for an asset-based stock. Now, by stating their basis for recommending the special dividend, the defendants assumed an obligation to provide a description that was accurate, full, and fair. The value enhancement statement was misleading because the GM stock, GMH stock, was asset-based. Because the one-for-one exchange reference ignored that 17% of the GMH stock that was converted into U stock was then going to immediately be converted into News American Depository shares, and so it wouldn't be a one-for-one exchange into U's. And it was also misleading because it implied that GM was suffering some loss for which it was entitled to compensation. Now, the defendants also attempted to justify the special dividend based on an analogy to the intercompany payment made in the EDS split-off, and that was also misleading. Having made the analogy, they were required to give a full and fair account, including the differences between the transactions. The EDS split-off was not driven by GM's pension funding needs, and in the EDS transaction, GM's Class E shares were exchanged for shares of EDS. GM didn't sell off its retained interest. And may I check out to, am I into my reply time?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Your Honor, I'll save the balance for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I rise to introduce Robert Kopecky from Kirkland & Ellis, who will present the argument on behalf of the GM defendants.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Robert Kopecky, and I represent the GM defendants. May it please the Court. The transactions at issue in this case were subject to approval by both classes of GM's common stock. That approval was solicited through a detailed and meticulous consent solicitation document that detailed the terms of the transaction, the background of the transaction, how the board arrived at its decision to approve it, why it recommended it, and a detailed recitation of the analysis performed by four investment banking firms. In October 2003, GM announced that it had received the votes necessary by both classes of stock to approve the transaction. That report disclosed that of the Class H holders, the ones whose issues, whose interests are at issue here, of the Class H holders, roughly 80% of the outstanding voted, and of those, 95% of the Class H holders voted in favor of the transaction. 75% of the total outstanding Class H stock voted in favor of the transaction.
Can you help us with this legal proposition that the votes that were cast, the percentages, and everything else is something that's proper for judicial notice?
Your Honor, I think it is clearly proper for judicial notice. The complaint, to begin with, the complaint alleges that the transaction was conditioned upon approval of both classes of stockholders. The complaint alleges that the transaction closed. It does not allege that that condition was not satisfied. The Santa Fe Court, counsel said that Santa Fe said it was improper to take judicial notice of this hearsay. Santa Fe says in footnote 9, despite the fact that an SEC filing may constitute hearsay with respect to the truth of the matter asserted therein, courts may consult these documents to ascertain facts appropriate for judicial notice.
However we get to it, I'll be more direct. If you can take judicial notice of the fact that a vote occurred and what the percentage was, and if someone would like to contest the vote separately, there seems to be an inconsistency, because at least if you look at the cases and what you take judicial notice of, they appear to be things that no one could reasonably contest. And here the allegation is we want to contest the vote, we want to show it was manipulated or whatever.
Well, manipulation is a different issue. We're talking about the count of the vote. And I submit, Your Honor, they have no reasonable basis for challenging the count of the vote. And in fact, as Your Honor pointed out to counsel, they conceded that argument before Chancellor Chandler.
Well, that's the reason I brought it up, because it's one thing to say you consider something on a motion to dismiss that you shouldn't have, and it's another thing to say, well, whether you should have considered it or not, you conceded it, so it's a non-issue.
And I believe they did, Your Honor. They now say that the Chancellor shouldn't have considered that, but at the argument they told them they had no reason to contest it. And I would call to the Court's attention this Court's en banc decision in Malapete versus Townsend, in which the Court discussed taking judicial notice of a document outside the pleadings. And in that case, the plaintiffs said, we should have been allowed to take discovery to find out if this document was authentic or not. And this Court said, if you don't have a reasonable basis for doubting your authenticity, you're not entitled to take discovery. You can't simply say, we want to find out. You have to have a basis for believing there's something wrong. And when the vote took, this wasn't like the state of Florida presidential election. 95% of the shares that voted in favor of this transaction. It's not like, you know, we missed a couple votes and it would have gone the other way. It was an overwhelming vote. There was no basis for questioning that vote. Mr. Hanrahan made a representation to this Court that no third party verified the vote. I don't know what basis he has for saying that. In fact, Equiserve, an independent third party, did verify the vote. It's not in the record, but if he's going to stand up here and make representations to the Court should know that that's simply not true.
But on the point of judicial notice, should we look to the rules of evidence to define what can be judicially noticed, or is there some other doctrine?
I believe Rule 201 is probably the starting point for where you would look. And the courts have looked to the rules of evidence as the touchstone. In Malapete, this Court looked to the rules of evidence as the touchstone and said the rule as being the Court may take judicial notice of facts that are not subject to reasonable dispute and are subject to ready and accurate determination. Now, any shareholder could have had access to those votes through the mechanism of Section 220. So the vote totals were definitely readily accessible to shareholders, if anyone had a question about that. The votes were there and accessible. And there was no reasonable basis for challenging that vote.
So it's comparable to finding out what the weather was on a particular day by checking a record somewhere.
I would submit it is, Your Honor. Unless there is some basis for believing that there was an inaccurate vote count. And here there is none. There's none alleged in the complaint. And counsel has conceded an argument that they have no basis. In terms of applying the correct standards, we submit, Your Honor, that Chancellor Chandler applied the correct standards on every issue in this case. In every issue, his decision rests firmly on decisions of this court. That includes his taking judicial notice of the vote total. It is true that on a motion to dismiss, the court is required to accept as true well-pleaded facts. The court is not required to accept conclusions, but without supporting allegations. The court is not required to accept, again, as this court said in Mallaby, every strained interpretation of those allegations. The court is only required to accept inferences that flow logically from the facts alleged. And what the chancellor did was he looked at the allegations and he looked at what inferences were reasonable. He disregarded conclusions. He disregarded pejorative characterizations, which he was not required to accept as true. Your Honor, we believe shareholder ratification disposes of essentially all the claims in this case. The Delaware courts have long recognized that giving shareholders the right to approve a transaction affecting their interests is the ultimate procedural protection. And accordingly, this court has said that an informed shareholder vote concludes the matter, absent fraud, waste, or some other basis for challenging the ratification.
Well, if we get to that point, you do have to focus on the distinction that the briefs discussed on whether Williams and Geirish really said you can ratify care, but we left loyalty open for another day, or can this be resolved based on ratification without we're still leaving that open to another day.
Your Honor, I believe the application of the ratification doctrine to the breach of loyalty claims in this case is settled law. There are a variety of contexts in which the breach of loyalty can arise.
And what are the cases?
Well, and the cases are, well, to begin with, Solomon versus Armstrong, in which this court affirmed the decision of the Court of Chancery for the reasons stated and on the basis of that court's opinion. And in Solomon versus Armstrong, the court said, relied on the settled proposition that shareholder ratification by a majority of disinterested shareholders acts as a safe harbor where directors' potentially conflicting self-interests are at stake. That's the kind of breach of loyalty claim we have here. As
we
can explain.
We fall back to, if the disclosure is full and complete, the ratification takes care of everything.
Right. And we're not, just to be clear, we're not saying that in a loyalty claim, ratification totally extinguishes the claim. What it does do, and what the court said in Solomon, was that it invokes the business judgment rule. And Solomon was based on a long line of this court's decisions. Michelson versus Duncan in 1979, this court held that shareholder ratification of a transaction involving allegedly self-interested directors invoked the business judgment rule. In Marciano versus Nakash, this court applied the same rule, invoking section 144.82 of the Delaware Corporation Law. And again, saying the business judgment rule is invoked. And in that event, the transaction may be challenged only if the plaintiffs can allege waste or gift. There is no allegation of waste in this case.
So if I follow that, then the natural corollary is that if, in fact, the business judgment rule applies, then when the directors who are alleged to have a conflict make their decision about whether the sale should take place in order to put $4 billion into a pension plan or whatever the correct number is, or they should have been looking out at the interest of the GMH shareholders, then we don't second-guess that judgment.
If you give the GMH shareholders the right to veto that transaction upon full disclosure.
Right.
Yes.
If we accept your theory for ratification, then any scrutiny of this of the director's conflict of interest or lack of independence or lack of disinterestedness would be resolved by the business judgment rule.
I believe that's right, and I believe the 25 years of this court's decisions have so held, Your Honor.
Is there any issue about whether the vote totals that you discussed a few moments ago, and I apologize for not asking the question, any suggestion that looking at the public documents in 202-20 action wouldn't have revealed the percentage of that majority that was by pension or other captured votes?
Because what you're wondering, you can see it simply by looking at the document itself. And it's page B52 of our appendix.
Okay.
The vote total shows that of the Class A shares, I'll take Proposition 3, because that's the one approving the dividend, which plaintiffs attack. 854 million shares voted yes. Plaintiffs allege that 382 million shares were owned by the pension funds or some benefit plan of GM. 382 million. So if you assume all those voted in favor, because that's what plaintiffs would have the court assume. So assume that. You take 382 million out of 850 million, that still leaves something like 470 million shares unaffiliated with GM voted in favor of the transaction. So we can see that simply by looking at the vote totals.
I'm just saying, even if the new voting stock hadn't been issued, the vote count reflects that the other people would have carried the day anyway.
Your Honor, if the 149 million shares had not been contributed, then 73.5% of the outstanding H shares would have voted in favor of this, and of the shares voting, 97% would have voted in favor, if you throw out those shares. So the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of this transaction, and you can see that from the public documents. Let me talk for just a minute about the manipulation claim. Plaintiffs rely on Blasius Industries versus Atlas Corp. The standard in that case is that where plaintiffs show the defendants acted for the primary purpose of thwarting the exercise of the shareholder vote, then the burden shifts to the defendants to justify their conduct. Williams versus Geyer pointed out that this court has rarely applied that standard because it is so draconian. The linchpin for applying the Blasius standard is that there has to be a showing that the intent was to thwart what appears to be the will of the majority of the shareholders. There is no allegation in this complaint, no hint of an allegation in this complaint, that a majority of the Class A shareholders unaffiliated with GM opposed this transaction. There is no hint that any significant minority opposed this transaction. There is no hint that anybody other than this plaintiff opposed this transaction. So this the predicate for Blasius simply doesn't exist here in what the plaintiffs have alleged. They haven't alleged that there was opposition to which GM had any reason to thwart the plaintiffs. Beyond that, they haven't alleged any effect that the contribution had on the vote. The totals I gave to Your Honor a minute ago show that even if you had never made that contribution, it would have passed overwhelmingly. I have about a minute left. I want to at least touch on Article 7, which plaintiffs contend required a two-thirds vote to carry this transaction. Article 7 is, by its plain terms, permissive. It says that the directors may take certain actions upon obtaining a two-thirds vote. This court's decision in Centaur Partners versus National Intergroup said that supermajority voting requirements are disfavored in the state because they tend to disenfranchise majorities. And the court said that in order to find a supermajority requirement, that requirement must be clear and unambiguous, and there must be no doubt that that is what the shareholders intended. Your Honors, we respectfully submit you cannot read the language of Article 7 and find that it clearly and unambiguously imposes a two-thirds requirement for this transaction.
So is your 271 argument and the majority of the entity argument, is that an alternative argument to what you just told us?
It's not an alternative argument. Our position is charter provision says in furtherance and not in limitation of the powers conferred by law. Section 271 confers powers upon a simple majority. This provision is in furtherance of and not in limitation of that power conferred by statute. And therefore, we believe plaintiffs cannot conceivably read this as a mandatory provision saying you must get a two-thirds vote, not in the face of that language. unless the court has any questions, I have 6 seconds left. So
thanks very much.
Hey, please, yes. Court. I'm Edward Welch from Skadden, Arps, Slate, Martin Farm. We represent the News Corporation Limited, which has been referred to periodically as either News or TMCL. It's an Australian entity. We respectfully request that the dismissal of the aiding and abetting claim by the court below should be affirmed. Again, if the court please, that's a de novo standard. No inferences or conclusions are granted without specific facts. Aiding and abetting requires not only a fiduciary duty, but of course breach of that fiduciary duty and knowing participation. We believe that the News briefs and the News arguments, pardon me, the GM briefs and GM arguments substantiate the fact that there was no breach of duty. But even beyond that, there was certainly no knowing participation in any breach of duty by TMCL or News. At the outset, we think Chancery properly rejected any connection between the special dividend, which was paid by Hughes to GM, and any concept of knowing participation. The settled law in Delaware, in case after case, is that if there's a diversion of money, in order to sustain an aiding and abetting claim, it has to be to a fiduciary. Here, the diversion of money, if indeed you can properly characterize it that way, and I think you can, it was simply a dividend, was made to General Motors, to GM. GM, of course, in a context like this, is not a fiduciary. The case law on this is profound and goes on extensively. McGowan, USA Cafes, Jackson National, Senate Metals, Rand, Crescent.
Is your focus on the merits an indication that if you prevailed on this point, you don't want us to reach the jurisdictional issue, or are you going to talk about that too?
No, I would like to talk about the, Mr. Justice Holland, the jurisdictional issue. I think there are powerful answers to that. I believe they both have essentially equal dignity. I recognize we have a limited time period, that's all. I do believe that there is no showing on this record, in the briefs or otherwise, of any known participation by News International. Certainly not, Mr. Justice Holland, with respect to the special dividend, it simply isn't there. Nor is there any connection, including the one that they try to draw, between the special dividend and the purported reduction that News was prepared to make, as they say, in the amount of Hughes shares it was prepared to purchase. The fact of the matter is, as the Chancellor pointed out, that allegation is utterly conclusory, but plainly contradicted by the very consent document that they purport to rely on. The 36% that was initially raised was raised by GM and Hughes and not by News International, TMCL. The fact is, TMCL said at the outset it wanted to purchase 34%. There's just nothing in the record, not a shred of evidence anywhere that would contradict that. So as to the diversion of money argument as a basis for an aiding and abetting claim, the Chancellor is correct. It is utterly conclusory. It is not supported by the document that they relied upon, and that's very clear. We believe the Chancellor was also correct and properly rejected the argument that TMCL knowingly participated in a breach because of a benefit it received as to a lack of a control premium. The fact of the matter is there's no case law that says that a control premium is required in any sense, where 34% is being required. Of course, there's also a very, very clear and profound case law which makes the point that there's no change of control where one control person is simply substituted for another one. The Digest case makes that point very clearly. And beyond that, what did News do? What News did, TMCL did, was simply to negotiate in its own interest. And there's extensive admissions in this complaint that that's the case. I won't burden the court with those now, but we cover them in our brief extensively. The Court of Chancery below covered them extensively. News was negotiating in its own interest. Now, they also try to contend that there was aiding and abetting in some fashion by virtue of the consent statement, and that there was knowing participation there. Again, their argument is that somehow the consent statement mischaracterized what the result would be of News making this acquisition. It is simply unsupported by the very document that they relied upon. News and the consent statement made it very clear that upon conclusion of this transaction, that News would have a significant influence over Hughes. Again, it's clear not only from the consent statement, but indeed they allege it in their own complaint in paragraphs 141 and several of the paragraphs that follow that. As to the other disclosure allegations that they try to attach to News, again, there simply are no facts that TMCL was in a position to decide for GM what GM should be disclosing, very much like Rio Grande, where Your Honors will recall there was also a joint press release, and the court said as to one party's disclosures, there were a problem as to that party, but as to the other party's disclosures, they simply were not, and there was no reason to attribute one to the other. I see my time has run. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Welch.
Just touch on a few points and leave a little time for Mr. Jarvis. We now are told, the complaint alleges that no independent inspector of election was divulged in the consent solicitation or in the 10Q or anywhere else. Now, at the Supreme Court level, we're getting new facts today as it just goes on, and we, of course, have no opportunity to respond to that. Mr. Capecchi raises Section 220. Well, this case was already pending. There was a motion to dismiss pending, and we sought discovery regarding the vote. And we were turned down by the court below. So to now say, oh, Section 220, any stockholder could have gotten the information, well, they didn't give it to us when we asked for it in this case. With respect to Solomon,
are you saying we brought a 220 action?
No, Your Honor. We were faced with a motion to dismiss that relied on matters outside of the complaint and consistent with the rules. That converts it into a motion for summary judgment. We asked for discovery on it, and instead we were turned down. We did not get any discovery, and now they say, oh, a Section 220 action. This action had been pending for many months. Solomon, again, that's the EDS transaction, and you did not have the conflict of fiduciary duties there that you have in this case. Now, they throw around a lot of percentages, but these plans owned hundreds of millions of GMH shares beyond the $149 million that was given to them. So to try to say, oh, yeah, it really was a full and fair vote, even if you exclude the $149, and they throw a lot of numbers at the court, we don't agree with that, and we think we were entitled to an opportunity to test that.
What's your comment on the concession that you made before the Chancellor? Apparently, it's no basis to challenge them.
I think the context there, Your Honor, was that in terms of being able to point to specific consents or some problem in counting the consents, obviously we can't, under Rule 11, allege something that we can't possibly know. But what we do say is that there was not a fair ratification by disinterested stockholders. They mention the plan. They don't mention that there were a huge number of employees and retirees who also owned GMH stock. And we can't tell from the public record and not from that 10Q how many of the shares of theirs are represented in the votes for this transaction.
That would be contained. You still have 45 seconds. He has his own 2 minutes.
Okay.
So you're suggesting that in the $850 million or whatever the number was that's stated in the document that the Chancellor relied upon, there's uncertainty as to how many of those shares were owned by pensioners or other retired GM employees who might have owned shares?
Or use employees. And Your Honor, we allege in the complaint that there were special solicitations that were started before the consent statement went out to others, that were directed at the employees. There was a real effort to get those who were going to have a substantial financial interest in this transaction going through because their pension benefits were going to get a real plus to the tune of $3 to $4 billion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Court. I want to briefly respond to a couple of Mr. Welch's points and then also respond to some of the jurisdiction points in his brief. First, as to the point on whether News knowingly participated in the agreement, he says that there was never any discussion of the possibility that News would purchase more than 34%, and therefore our allegation that they took a 2% less in exchange for allowing GM to take $275 million is belied by the very own consent statement. What that says is that GM considered allowing News to take up to 36%. It says News ultimately took 34%, and it also says in connection in the next sentence to see what we're dealing with that there was a $275 million payment made from News to GM, which would, of course, not have been permitted had News not agreed to it. The inference can be made to the plaintiffs, which they, of course, don't want to, that there was an, in fact, exchange for 2 2% for $275 million. Without discovery, we can't prove exactly what happened, but to suggest that there was never a suggestion of 36% is on page A420 of the record, which is the consent statement. Speaking briefly on the issue of jurisdiction, in their reply slash answering brief, they argue that the Arrow Global decision of this court is inapplicable, and they argue three reasons. In case they didn't mention their opening brief, we brought it up, we believe it is controlling authority in this particular case. They argue that, first, that there is no statement by us, anywhere in the brief, of what NPAL, the News Corp subsidiary, what its purpose was. And Arrow Global, Your Honors, had decided that a subsidiary of FIOB, a foreign investment bank, called Crescent, had been established some years before for a purpose of engaging in particular investments in the United States, but that earlier incorporation and then the use of it in the transaction for the purpose of the underlying matters was sufficient to confer jurisdiction. In this case, we specifically allege on page 27, note 21 of our brief, that the purpose of NPAL was in fact engaged in the news business in the United States. They say that in a consensual solicitation. So their statement is not true.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye. All members persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save.